When I was 13 years old, my grandfather passed away. He was the first member of my family, the first person that I knew who died. And I remember a few things about that day when we went for his memorial service. I remember there were a lot of my aunts and uncles and cousins all in one house, which made for an interesting mix. And then I remember, too, there was a lot of food. And I remember there was this moment in which my mom came into the bedroom in which I was staying and saying, some of the family is going down to the funeral home to see my grandfather's body. Would you like to go? And I thought about it, and I said, can you describe what that is? And so she did. And as she described it, I thought to myself, I don't really think I want to go. I don't think that's something I'm interested in. What she described is that he would be dressed in a nice suit, his Sunday suit. His body would be filled with preservatives to keep him looking fresh. She didn't use the word preservatives, but that's the guts of it. And he would be laid in a wooden box with satin pillows. And I thought, that's not my grandfather. So I was not interested in going. And I'm not saying that those who do go to pay their respects, that doesn't honor that person. I'm just saying, for me, I knew that there was no life in the body. I knew that going and seeing my grandfather in that space, there was no breath in him. There would be no conversation with him. Since that time, and through my work in hospice, I have seen many other people who have passed. I've seen many bodies, and it has confirmed to me that when the body has passed, there is no breath in the body. We start this way because this is the way James finishes his chapter 2. So I invite you at this time, if you have a Bible and are following along with us, to open up to James chapter 2. And we're going to start a little different this morning. We're going to start at the end of the passage. And at the end of James chapter 2, James gives us a vivid and a shocking image. That image is this. He concludes his passage, just as the body is dead without breath, so also faith is dead without good works. Just as the body is dead without breath, so also faith is dead without good works. The image that James wants to leave in our minds is that of this. It's a body, it's on a slab, there is no breath coming out of it, it is a corpse. It's a faith corpse. And he says, that is a shocking image, yes. But it's shocking only so much as we equate that faith without works is the same corpse. And so, because I love a good crime show, which usually starts in the morgue with, you know, the coroner pulling out this drawer and showing you a body, and then it's like, well, how did they get here? And then they flash back and they show you what happened in the person's life. We're going to do the same thing this morning. We're going to flash back and we're going to ask the question, how does a person become a faith corpse? How do you get to this point in your life where it is just your faith? There is nothing that animates your life. And so we begin with what is a shocking image, but this morning we are going to follow a path. It is the story of how a person can become a faith corpse. James is our guide, and he will show us examples of both faith and anti-faith in hopes that we will be wise and choose that faith will save us. And so if we were going to back up the tape, if we start with this image of this man on a slab and we, you know how they do, well, it's better sound than that. But they rewind the tape and you see the same man, except now he's alive. And in this scene, he is walking out of a synagogue because James was likely writing to Jewish believers. And he's walking out of the synagogue and, oh my word, the choir was so good that morning. It just uplifted him and it filled him with so much hope, and it filled him with so much good feeling, and the sermon, It was a fantastic sermon. It probably wasn't me preaching. It was somebody preaching, and they were preaching a fantastic sermon, and it resonated exactly with what he needed to hear. And at the end, the creme de la creme, the benediction that came out, and it was spoken over him, and may God bless his life. And he knew that God had blessed his life and blessed it richly. And so he heard this benediction, and he soaked it in. And he turns and he walks out of the synagogue. He walks right through those doors. And as he walks through those doors, there is a man coming in for the second service. And this man is simply in a t-shirt. And it is raining and it is cold outside. And he comes in and he is clearly underdressed for the environment. And as he comes in, you can just see the look of hunger in his eyes. And our man, who has just come out of the first service, looks at this man and he says, I know what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to speak a benediction over you. I'm going to speak a benediction over your life. And that benediction is this: goodbye and have a good day, stay warm and eat well. It is this blessing that I speak over your life. And most of us listen to that story and say, that is horrible. How is it that you cannot understand that the God who poured so much blessing into your life did not also empower you then to bless other people? But for this man, he has made a distinction. He just simply offers casual words that he tosses to a person in real need. He knows the words don't have any weight, and he doesn't care. If pressed, he will likely make the argument we find in verse 18. Now, someone may argue, some people have faith and others have good deeds, but I say to you, how can you show me your faith if you don't have good deeds? I will show you my faith by my good deeds. So the man coming out may say, he may make this argument, well, you have good deeds. I know that's a part of the religious experience, but that's not my part. My part is faith. I have faith. It's what I experience in this church. That's my part. I have faith. And what James is saying is you cannot illustrate your faith by simply showing up and speaking benedictions. You have to illustrate it by good deeds. This man's faith has become relative, or what we might call a private faith. And I know many people in my life who have said, well, my faith is something that I simply do privately. It's I exercise it privately. It is the orthodox teachings of the church, but I choose not to exercise that in the public sphere. Well, Jesus, when he came into the world, he did not come into the private sphere. He came into the public sphere. And if we are to follow him, we are to follow him into the public sphere. And so I give, or I offer you, so this man, he might simply say that, well, my faith is like a jewel that I keep in my pocket. And he will pull it out and look at it every once in a while and say, oh, how beautiful that is. And then I'll put it back in my pocket until I return to a place where I can feel safe enough to look at it. That is his definition of faith. The definition of faith that I want to offer you this morning is this, and I believe it comes from James. Faith is the actions which entrusts ourselves to God and thereby renders meaning to the rest of our lives. Faith is the actions which entrusts ourselves to God and thereby renders meaning to the rest of our lives. So faith, then, is our alignment with God's mission and purpose in the world, not only to redeem the world, but to renew it person by person. We are being renewed into the image of Jesus as we walk in the way of Jesus. These are simply some of the semantics about faith. And there are more semantics that are probably important to pay attention to, because if some of you have read some of Paul's writings, you'll remember that Paul says this in Ephesians chapter 2, it is by grace that you are saved through faith and not of works that any person should boast. So is Paul saying something that is opposite of James here? Is Paul saying it is not works that save you. It's faith that saves you. And James is saying, nope, it's not faith that saves you. It's works that save you. Are James and Paul opposite each other? And I sat with this for a little bit this week, and I pondered this because I think this is a real question. But I think, as I pondered this and as I read a little bit more context in both what James was saying and Paul was saying, I think the essence of what Paul is saying is this. If you are relying on your works to impress God, know that your works will not save you. If you think your works are something that you do that impresses God, and you have no faith, you put no trust in God, know that your works will not save you. James likely is saying this. If you think that your words of faith will impress God and you don't have works that match those faith, know that that faith will not save you. So Paul is saying, don't trust in the works to impress God. James is saying, don't trust in the faith to impress God. Essentially, both are saying this. If your life, the outside of your life, is not congruent with the inside of your life, God is not impressed. God came to redeem us so that we would be whole persons. It's this word shalom. It means that the inside matches the outside, that we are whole persons, and we have been redeemed for that purpose. The measure of our faith is not in what we know, or even our proficiency and discipline of prayer, scripture reading, church attendance, or even tithing. And what can become dangerous about these activities is we can rely on them as a substitute for faith. We can say, well, I go to church, and I tithe, and I read my Bible, and so therefore I'm practicing my faith. But there's ways to do that that are inherently private and don't ever take you out into this public sphere. And God is using us as the agents of change, to bring renewal to this world. If we rewind the tape even further back, so we started at the synagogue, if we're going to rewind the tape even further back, we go past this man's birth, we go into Israel's history, we even go beyond Israel's history into heaven. And we see in heaven that there are some group of angels that have decided they're going to rebel against God. They don't like God's purposes in the world, and so they're going to rebel against God. And as they rebel against God's purposes in the world, they are cast out of heaven and they take up a resistance against God and his purposes in the world. And those are known through the Bible as demons. And this is what James says about demons as we continue to read down in this passage. This first example is probably the most salient for us today. James says, a little sarcastically, that it's good that his readers level, faith level, is on par with the demons. And basically what he's saying is this. Look, the demons know that God is one. This phrase, God is one, in your text, it comes from the Shema, or Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. It's this prayer that all of the believers, the early believers, would pray. It would be similar to us coming here and saying the Lord's Prayer. They would say it almost every time they gathered. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. And they would say it over and over and over again. And James is saying, yeah, the demons know that too. The demons know that. But that does not line up the demon's life with God. Essentially, James is saying this. Faith does not equal belief. Faith and belief are not the same thing. Belief is knowing something or choosing to know something or to align yourself with something. Faith is actually putting that into practice. He's saying the demons have belief. They know that there is one God who judges the heavens and the earth. But the demons have not put any faith in this God. In fact, they have chosen the opposite. They have chosen to align themselves against him. Kenneth Bailey describes this predicament well. He says this, he who believes in the existence of God but who lives as if God were not has fallen much farther from God than he who has difficulty in believing in God's existence yet lives in such a way as often to put believers to shame. Here's the important thing. The real unbeliever is not he whose life witnesses to a belief that he thinks he does not possess, but rather he who whose life proves that he does not really believe what he thinks he believes. The real unbeliever is the one whose life proves that he does not really believe what he thinks he believes. The second example for us comes from the life of Abraham. You remember the song, Father Abraham had many sons. Okay, I'm the only one singing. Anyway, Father Abraham, before Father Abraham had many sons, Father Abraham had no sons, zero sons. In fact, Father Abraham had zero sons for years and years and decades, and Abraham desperately wanted a son. And so he and his wife, though struggling through infertility, prayed, and God came to Abraham and said, Abraham, I will give you a son. And so Abraham waited, and he waited. He waited for decades. In fact, he got tired of waiting, and finally he took his wife Sarah's handmaid, and he slept with her. And so then they had a son that way, which was not really the way of faith. And God came to him and said, despite your lack of faith, yet still I will be faithful to you and provide you a son. And in Abraham and Sarah's old age, he did give them a son. That son's name was Isaac. It means laughter. I kind of imagine Abraham and Sarah now approaching 100 years old thinking, we just had a child. It's either funny or crazy. We'll go with funny. We'll go with funny. So they laugh. They laugh until the word of the Lord comes again. Now Isaac is 13 years old. The word of the Lord comes again to Abraham and says, I want you to take your son Isaac and I want you to climb the most sacred mountain, Mount Moriah, and I want you to offer Isaac on an altar as a sacrifice to me. If I am Abraham, this is what I say to God. No. No. I waited my whole life. My whole life. And I made some mistakes along the way. But you have been faithful and you have given me the son. He's the only son I have. I do not get another chance after this. No, I am not going to climb that mountain. That's what I would say, if I'm being honest. Abraham instead chooses to believe in the goodness and the sovereignty of God, climbs the mountain, puts a son on the altar, goes to sacrifice a son, and the Lord steps in again and says, wait. I have provided another sacrifice for you in your son's place. And because you have ruthlessly trusted me, I know now that you live by faith, and I declare you righteous as a result. So James' second example is Abraham and the way he lived out, giving up the most valuable thing in his life, his son, as a means of faith. The third example, James' next example, is that of Rahab. So James moves from the pinnacle of Israel's faith, which is Abraham. He fathered the entire nation. Everyone reveres Abraham. He goes up this sacred mountain to offer this religious act of rite in faith. And from there, we move to from one of the highest points on earth to almost one of the lowest. Jericho sits at nearly one of the lowest points in the world. Rahab at that time was a prostitute. She had nothing to do with God. She lived outside of God's blessing. She lived in Jericho. Two spies come in. Israel is about to come into the land. They're about to conquer Jericho. Rahab can see what's coming. The spies come in. Instead of taking those spies and turning them over to the authorities, Rahab takes the spies, brings them into her house, and says, I want you to hide in my closet until I can help you escape. And so this third example, it's totally different. It's an act of political subversion. So James' second example is an act of religious rite. His third example is this act of political subversion. What James is illustrating to us today is that there are many, many ways to trust a good, faithful, and sovereign God in our lives. Some of those are more demonstrative and they're active. Some of those look very different, like Rahab's act of faith in which she chose to trust God, hide the spies, and as a result, she was spared. The thing that I find beautiful about these contrasting stories is that faith works itself out in very, very different ways. And the only way we really know these stories is when we get together in community and we tell these stories to each other. I knew a family once that told me a story about a time, a season in their life when they felt like the Lord came to them and said, I want you to give away every single penny in your bank account right now. They prayed about it. They thought, this is strange. Doesn't make sense. Don't know why we're doing this, but we feel such a strong impression that we need to do this, that we're going to do that. So they did it, and there was this crazy, bizarre story of how grace showed up in their life and providence came from ways they didn't expect, and by the next month's bills, they had everything they needed. Now, I don't tell you that story to say, therefore, you should all go give all of that away. That story actually had a greater purpose. You see, the family only did this one time, and this wasn't an act of piety for them. They weren't going and telling other people about this. In fact, I didn't hear about this story until years after it happened. So they held this to themselves, and less than a year later, my friend, the father, had an opportunity to leave a very secure job and start out on his own with another Christian brother to start a firm around something that he believed in. But he had incredible doubts about providing for his family. You see, his job had provided him security and stability for so many years. He knew that it was God who gave him that job and provided the security. And starting out on his own meant entering into a season with a lack of security. And as he and his wife talked about this, they remembered the time in which God had asked them to give away everything in their account and how God had come back and provided for them again. And it was that moment of faith, that trusting in the providence of God, that allowed him to take the next step, because he knew that God was faithful. That story is important to me, because there are moments in my life when, even though I know and I can remember the faithfulness of God, I doubt. And part of our call to be a community together as the called out ones is that we are people who live by faith in 1,000 different ways that is played out. And we need to hear the stories of each other, because we all grow weak in our faith. And we need to be encouraged and remembered that God is being faithful even now in the lives of us all. Living our faith in community also gives us opportunity to put into practice the works of faith. As a church, Calvin has taken some very direct steps to addressing hunger and homelessness in our community, including our Deacon Pantry, which hands out food every week. But it would be a mistake for all of us to say, well, I know my church is doing something about hunger and homelessness, so that gives me the ability to simply walk by people who are hungry and perhaps homeless. You see, James' message is to the individual believer here, saying, it's not about what programs your church does. It's about how you interact with the programs. It's how you interact with people who interact with the programs. And so this is an invitation. If you're saying, I hear this message and I know I need to put my faith into practice, but I have no idea how, we are always looking for people to engage with those who are in need, who come to our Deacon's Pantry. Always looking for people. And that is only one opportunity. There are many opportunities around us. This brings us all the way back to the verse we started with, verse 26. Just as a body is dead without breath, so faith is dead without works. So on the surface, this kind of seems backwards to me. It seems, if I were going to make the equation, that the body would be the works part and the faith would be the spirit part, because the faith is kind of the inner part that you can't really see, and the spirit's the inner part that you can't really see, and the body is the part you can see, and the works are the part that you can see on the outside. But James actually takes these things and he reverses them. He crosses them. He says, look, no. It's your faith, which is your body, and the works that animate your body is that which is done by the Spirit. So your faith is that which you declare. It's that which you're, it's your persona. But your persona, who you are in the world, what you choose to believe, is only as animated as the works which God gives you to do, to walk in, that you do. And if there are no works that animate your body, then your body is dead. Your faith is dead. We think the works are the what we do on the outside. James says, no, the works actually come from within. They are led by the Spirit. They are Spirit opportunities that we step into as we follow Jesus into this broken world that needs him so much. And as we do that, we see that God is faithful. My hope for us this morning is to encourage us to think critically about faith in our own lives. If it is simply faith as part of your life, or is faith rather something that renders meaning to every other aspect of your life? And this brings us to the disciplines. We have been focusing every week on a particular discipline that helps us live out faith and work. Through the series, we have been recommending these disciplines to you. Last week, Neil mentioned that secret service might be a way to address favoritism and partiality in our own lives. We're going to continue the theme of service this week, but I'm going to add a little bit of a different twist to service from secrecy. And that is, look for serving opportunities that have little or no status attached to them. I think one of the things that often keeps me from engaging in service is I wonder how I will be perceived, or will I be able to sustain in something that has little or no status. And I think one of the reasons I think this is because I forget what Jesus said in Luke chapter 22, when he said this: those who are greatest among you should take the lowest rank, and the leader should be like a servant. So what Jesus is inviting us to is a life of faith in service and works to other people in which our ego is taken out of the equation. And we intentionally pursue this by pursuing roles that are beneath us, that are base, that have no status attached to them. It's part of the work of the Christian. This is a purposeful serving that reminds us that faith needs works so that it does not become a corpse. Won't you join me in prayer? Lord Jesus, I ask that you would be with us this morning. Not just with us here in spirit, but as we leave this place, may your Spirit be going ahead of us. May you be showing us how it is that we are to engage this world, the needs of this world that needs you so much. We thank you that you are faithful, that James has reminded us that you have been faithful time and time again, and we can trust you. I pray that we do trust you this morning. I ask these things now in your name, in Jesus' name, amen.